Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. On this week's edition, are Michigan voters looking at the nation's most expansive abortion proposal? John Birch, vice president of appellate advocacy for the Alliance Defending Freedom, argues why that is the case. The Michigan Supreme Court justices got a little sassy in their opinions in the closing weeks of session in the opinion of Justice Brian Zara. He talks about that and his re-election effort. And Chris DeWitt of DeWitt Communications and John Pugh of Truscott Rossman talk about the Attorney General asking for a special prosecutor in the election tabulator theft case and Tudor Dixon's choices for lieutenant governor. With MERS writers Samantha Schreiber and Lisa Roos Church, here's MERS News editor Kyle Malin.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore. Well, we've got a very interesting week here in Michigan politics. Lisa Roos Church is joining us at the beginning of the podcast to talk about the Attorney General's decision to ask for a special prosecutor to look into allegations of election fraud and the taking of election equipment to try and prove that the 2020 election had some type of widespread voter fraud that impacted the results of the election. She has wrapped in Matt DiPerno, her Republican opponent, as part of that conversation, as part of that investigation, as well as Dare Rendon, state representative, and the Berry County Sheriff, Dar Leaf. Now, Lisa, as we were talking earlier, you thought that the request from the Attorney General to ask for a special prosecutor was late. Why did you say that?
I don't think you have to wait until the investigation is completed to make that request. I could be wrong, but I think at the point where it became clear that Matthew DiPerno was likely going to be her opponent, I would have thought that she would have stepped back just for the appearance of impropriety. I mean, why give your opponent ammunition that says this is purely political? And he's been saying that for a while now.
Chris DeWitt, you used to work for the Attorney General's office and now with DeWitt Communications. You were explaining before we were recording that a special prosecutor is appointed when there is a potential conflict with the prosecuting attorney, in this case, the Attorney General. And so she would go to the prosecutor's counsel and they would appoint somebody at that point. So as you were listening to Lisa speak here, do you think that the Attorney General was a little late in her request to get somebody else other than her office to look into this matter?
You raised a good point, but exactly what their reasoning was on the timing, we may find out down the road, but certainly don't know now.
Yes, I can't answer that question now, so don't ask.
At the very beginning of this launch from Matt DiPerno into the Attorney General's race, he was going off of the election conspiracy that this was widespread election fraud. He was up in Antrim County. He was acting at that time and trying to collect information. Was he bordering at that point on doing anything illegal, or does this have to do with him allegedly being a part of this group of people who were taking election equipment and then tearing it apart and trying to find, I don't know, the secret bug or, you know, whatever this was that was creating this theory of election fraud?
I think that's the big problem that he's got, the latter point you raised, just sitting there saying that things weren't done correctly, that in and of itself probably isn't a crime, but some of the other issues that have been raised in the couple letters that I've seen that the AG's office put out on this are, I think that's where the biggest problem sits. And by the way, you may get into this, but there's another referral that took place on this that should be noted to the Attorney Grievance Commission. I believe there are two attorneys that are mentioned in this, and I don't know if they were both referred, but I suspect they were. And, you know, they may be looking at losing their law license.
Yeah, that does seem that would be a major problem. And, you know, listening to his response today, and Matt DiPerno was on Michigan's Big Show with Michael Patrick Shields today. He said 90% of the facts that she lays out, that she calls facts in her petition, are either false or I have no knowledge of what she's talking about. So that's the 90%.
Let me add, I play tennis. And there's a line in tennis that a ball that is 99.9% outside the line is still in. And so if he's only 10% guilty, that can still get you in trouble.
Josh Pugh, you can hear from Trescott Rossman here. Josh, what do you make of all this?
I'm thinking I was trying to cook up a sports metaphor myself this morning, and I don't know that I'm going to match that one. That's pretty good. No, I mean, Chris is right. And what's more, I felt that the after having all of a Sunday night to come up with a response here, the response has been sort of all over the map, right? They're fundraising on saying it's not actually a crime, quote unquote. They are out here saying it's ridiculous. The DiPerno campaign, I think, doth protest a little too much. And this is supposedly an engagement that he raised $450,000 to support this investigation that he was undertaking. And now, for him to say, but in a completely non-specific way, that she's wrong doesn't really hold water, when other media have been dripping the details of this scandal and of this criminal activity for months and months.
No, I hear what you're saying on that, and it does seem that I wondered this at the very beginning when he was launching his attorney general campaign, if the campaign itself was not designed to say later in a criminal proceeding this is all political, that she's coming after me for political purposes, and that his actual launch for office was because of this very investigation he was pursuing.
Or if the campaign itself is just meant to be a massive GoFundMe to further the career of one Matt DiPerno, however else you would characterize that career.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next section of our podcast. We'll see what happens here as far as an independent investigation. But Tudor Dixon is the Republican nominee. She's going to be officially anointed at their convention coming up here after winning the primary election this past Tuesday. On the agenda to take care of is a running mate. Who is going to be her running mate? Now, Chris, you have some experience with this, having been with Governor Granholm when she was running her campaign, and then later Rick Snyder as he was running his campaign. What are some do's and don'ts here as she's looking at who she's going to name as her running mate?
Well, it's going to be fascinating, especially with the convention that she's going to have to deal with the delegates that she's got. When Granholm picked John Cherry, that was pretty easy to get through the convention. That worked well. When Snyder picked Callie, and even though I wasn't directly involved with that end of it, but certainly followed it, you know, that was a battle to get that through that convention, as you may remember. And Dixon is facing that same issue right now. I mean, remember, she's the establishment candidate. She's, you know, the insider. And if, from what I know of the makeup of the delegates to the Republican convention, they're going to want their person. And that may not fit with what Dixon's trying to move to the middle as much as she can, which is going to be a real rough time for her, but that's another subject. But or whoever she picks for her running mate, if it's somebody considered more in the middle, and that's a relative term for the Republican Party right now, you know, she could get stuck running with someone that really isn't her choice. They're going to have to do a lot of arm twisting to come up with somebody. And if they come up with somebody who is out there as some of those Republican gubernatorial candidates were, and the AG candidate, Secretary of State candidate, that could be a real burden for her.
I remember back to the Brian Kelly debacle with Wes Nakagiri. There's a difference here, though, in this particular race, and that is the rules of the Republican Party has changed. It has been in the past where the candidate for the Republicans had to go up in front of the convention, and the convention itself could pick an alternative, like Wes Nakagiri could run. This go around, the convention can turn down the nominee, but there is no alternative. And then the nominee can come back with another choice, and that person would have to get turned down. And then there's a third choice, and then that third choice would have to get knocked down, and then it gets opened up. So there is a little bit of difference here.
And thank you. I wasn't aware of that rule change. But that said, so let's say she comes up with a candidate. That candidate gets shot down. That's not going to look good. If you have to go that a second time and that happens, that's not going to look good. I don't know how many times they can play this thing out, but the delegates to the Republican convention are, I wouldn't call them mainstream anything.
I think we may have just solved this for the Dixon campaign, though. What about Wes Nakagiri? He's somebody who's got proven grassroots credentials, and he's legislating over in Livingston County, right? How about that?
There you go. It could just be Wes Nakagiri, right? He's got government experience, and he's run before.
Third choice. Third ballot.
All right. So, Josh, two of the names that have come out as possibilities, Mike Bishop, former Senate Majority Leader, former Congressman, and also another name, Jace Bolger, former Speaker of the House. What are some negatives here if she were to go in either of those directions?
I think the biggest negative in both cases is you got to find somebody with a worse job than Lieutenant Governor. And I don't know, I you saw it in Jace's quote to Paul Egan. He said, I have a great life. And Jace is somebody who is involved in a lot of decision making right now on the west side of the state in terms of setting the policy agenda for the right wing and for the Republican Party in a way that Lieutenant Governor may be, maybe not, but he's certainly not going to have to spend in his current job the next 90 days barnstorming around the state in the back of an RV. And Mike Bishop, when Nolan Finley called him, he was in Italy with his wife. In both cases, I think the challenge that the campaign and the candidate have, if they're going to go with either of those guys, is they've got pretty good gigs right now, and they've got pretty good setups right now, and you've got to persuade them to walk away from all that to become the lieutenant governor of a state that, either at best case scenario for a future Republican lieutenant governor, you have a unified Republican legislature, but I wouldn't call the Republican Party anything like unified right now. These are going to be some nasty fights in 2023, no matter what the composition of the legislature is, and no matter who the governor and no matter who the lieutenant governor is. And so that's a tough job.
Yeah, let me add, both of those guys would be, I think, considered establishment based on the criteria that at least some of those gubernatorial candidates were talking about. You know, Bolger's got a tie to DeVos. Bishop, I don't know so much about that particular issue, but, you know, he's a former congressman. I just have a feeling that they're not going to be looked upon too favorably if either one of them are chosen.
So where do you go then? Do you go to the middle or do you go, if you go to the middle, that's helping with the general election, but you go too far to the middle, then you have problems with the convention. But if you go and appease the convention, then you may have trouble for the general election.
I'm not sure what Ryan Kelly's doing, but you know, he's out there.
Well, he's contesting the election.
That's right. He's can. Never mind. I can't.
Maybe Garrett Saldano. I think Saldano's already acknowledged the results.
Well, so certainly somebody like that could help. But getting that person through a convention and on the ticket is one thing. But how does that person help you in the general election? And again, you know, let's face it, it's really going to come down to Whitmer versus Dixon.
Yeah, right.
The LG candidates are not going to get that much attention unless somebody's got some really crazy stuff out there. And if they go in that direction, you know, I don't know everything that Wes has said, but my general impression has been that there's probably some interesting comments he's made, and that could come back to haunt him. And so, you know, Dixon's in a tough spot. you got to get somebody through the convention, but you've got to have some level of, you know, how is the independent voter in Oakland County going to feel, for example? And they've got some issues.
Yeah, why is it, Josh, that it's harder for Republicans to come up with a good consensus lieutenant governor candidate? I remember Lisa Posthumus-Lyons was nominated by Bill Schuette, and she was jumped on because she didn't, she was squishy on whether she supported Trump, and then she voted for Medicaid expansion. That became an issue, too. You know, Chris mentioned John Cherry, but, you know, Schauer had Lisa Brown. Nobody had any problems with that. What is it with the Republicans?
I think that your lieutenant governor pick is ostensibly supposed to be the answer to a question, and it's not clear to me what question the Dixon campaign is trying to answer here, and it's not clear to me that they know. I think that the general mood of the Republican Party is certainly a big part of that right now, Kyle. There's a lot of anger on the ground, but it's not clear to me that anger is about anything necessarily that's fixable or real right now, right? Like there is nothing that's going to make that's going to put back the results of the 2020 election and install Trump as president, right? They've created grievances around these problems that are not real. And so they are not fixable. And so there is no candidate, whether Ryan Kelly or anyone else who can do what they want to, which is go back in time and win the 2020 election. And so they're going to be left asking these different questions, and whether they think the answer is somebody like Ken Horn or like James Craig, or whether they think the answer is Vinny the Microwave Johnson. I don't think that's going to be something that's going to be met with unanimous roaring approval from the convention delegates, which is their most important question right now in three Saturdays.
I should add, they really should be looking at Bill Lambier, because Lambier, right. I think, and Gilchrist would match up real well, at least on a basketball court.
Oh, that would be interesting to see Lambier post up on Garland Gilchrist.
I know as much about Bill Lambier's political leanings as I do about Benny the Microwave Johnson. So that's an excellent reference, Chris.
We'd have to see if Bill Lambier still lives in the state, though. That would be the question.
Details. Don't bother me with details.
Got right. 3 weeks till convention.
Yeah, right. We can get that taken care of. Well, thank you, Chris and Josh. Appreciate it. We're going to move on now to the next section of the podcast. You want it all.
Joining us now on the podcast is the Vice President of Appellate Advocacy for the Alliance Defending Freedom. He is John Birch. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
I wanted to have you on the podcast to talk about this ballot proposal that is in front of the Bureau of Elections right now to see if they have the signatures to put on the November ballot. It is the Michigan Right to Reproductive Freedom Initiative. And I had a hard time finding the actual language of the ballot proposal, but I finally did actually dig it up. And the reason I wanted to read it is because I've been starting to hear the negatives on this actual ballot proposal, that this would create, quote unquote, abortion on demand. And but as I was looking at this, John, there was a couple things that struck me. First of all, it says here in the text that an individual's right to reproductive freedom shall not be denied, burdened, or infringed upon unless justified by a compelling state interest achieved by the least restrictive means. That tells me that, at least at the very beginning, unless there's some guardrails here, that parental consent for minors seeking abortion would be in jeopardy under this constitutional amendment. Is that how you read it?
That's absolutely how I read it, Kyle. In fact, when they say every individual has a fundamental right at the very beginning, and they don't specify adults, that right off the bat signals to you that minors would have this too. So what that means is a minor could get an abortion without parental consent or even notification. And because the proposal also extends to sterilization, which would include sterilizations for transgender surgeries, because this talks about pregnant individuals, not about women, that means that a minor could even have a transgender sterilization without parental consent or notification. And I'm sure a lot would be surprised to learn that.
Because we're talking about reproductive freedom, having the right to make and effectuate decisions about all matters related to pregnancy, including but not limited to prenatal care, childbirth, postpartum care, contraceptive, sterilization, abortion care, miscarriage management, and infertility care. So that's where you're getting the transgender surgery is the sterilization.
Correct, the sterilization. And that's a really broad definition, and it says that it's included but not limited to these things. And because it also includes things like infertility care, and that means Michigan laws that regulate the business of in vitro fertilization with someone else's womb involved, a third party. Right now, Michigan strictly prohibits paying for surrogate parents and things like that. Those laws are probably also at risk.
What is the present day standard in Michigan when it comes to parental consent for abortion and then also sterilization for women?
Right now, you would have to have parental notice and consent. And there is a small exception for that if a minor had a situation with an adult parent, say that there was an incest or something like that, where they could go directly to the court and get court permission for that. But otherwise, in all other situations, you would need the parent involved. And that's the way that we typically do medicine with young people. If you had a 16-year-old and they were going to have an appendix out or a lung transplant or even something more minor, when I took my daughter to go get her ears pierced, I had to sign a consent form as her parent. This would really make abortion and infertility care and, like I said, these cross-gender sterilizations unique among all the medical procedures in Michigan when it came to parental consent and notification.
Yeah, but then what about female sterilization? Because I heard that, let's say you are a woman and you want to get your tubes tagged in Michigan. I heard that you have to either have a certain number of kids and that there's a whole process in that. Is that accurate, or what is the Michigan standard when it comes to sterilization practices?
I am not aware of any Michigan law that requires you to have a certain number of kids before you could have your tubes tied. Maybe someone could point me to that, but I've never heard that.
There's another section of this ballot proposal that I also wanted to talk to you about, and that has to do with when an abortion could take place. Under this ballot proposal, as of right now, it could, if it's passed, it could go all the way up to practically birth, correct?
Correct.
So there is language in here that says that the state could limit it after viability, but that doesn't start immediately upon adoption.
The viability portion of it would require the legislature to do some further work. They would have to pass an additional law to regulate abortion after viability, which is typically 21 to 23 weeks, depending on who you ask. But what's important for people to understand is that even there, there's an exception if, in the professional judgment of an attending healthcare professional, it's necessary to protect the life or, and this is the key part, physical or mental health of the pregnant individual. And that's the kind of an exception that you could drive a truck through. So say that you have a mother and she gets to 8.5 months of her pregnancy, and she says, well, I'm really worried that my physical health will be impacted by going through labor. That would be a reason for the attending medical physician to authorize abortion. Or say that they're even at the hospital, they're in labor because they've reached their due date, and they say, I think having a child is going to be bad for my mental health. An abortionist could use that as a reason to give them an abortion, even if the legislature had enacted laws that would try to restrict that in some ways. So it's a loophole that basically opens up abortion on demand all the way up to the moment of birth.
Isn't that a bit of an extreme perception, though? I mean, how many women actually get to the 8th or 9th month of pregnancy and say, oops, I made a mistake, give me an abortion?
There's very few that go that late, Lisa, but around the country, there's a not insignificant number of women who are getting third trimester abortion. That's why states act to regulate them. Now in Michigan, because of our 1931 pro-life law, that was supposed to have protected innocent unborn life beginning at conception. It was restricted by the Roe and Casey decisions that the U.S. Supreme Court decided. But as a result of that, we haven't had post-viability abortions in Michigan, even during Roe and Casey. But in other states, that's a very real concern.
Are you aware, though, if in those instances it's due to the mother's health or some physical deformity or problem with the fetus? Or is it simply because women have said, oops, I made a mistake?
It can be all of the above. There are abortionists who are willing to do third trimester abortions. I mean, I hate to bring this up because it was so horrific, but that Dr. Gosnell in Pennsylvania had a medical office that was filled with jars of third trimester fetuses that would have been completely healthy if they had been carried forward to term, with their arms and legs and things like that. It's not unheard of.
That's a good point.
And I can imagine that like any of these procedures would be very based off of medical discretion. And I guess when I kind of read the text of this amendment proposal, that it seems to be very dependent on what are those private conversations between an individual and a doctor. How would you describe this proposal's relationship when it comes to the concept of medical discretion?
Yeah, I think very dangerous. And I want to go back to the language that Kyle highlighted right at the very beginning, where the state shall not penalize, prosecute, or otherwise take adverse action against someone for aiding or assisting a pregnant individual in exercising the right to reproductive freedom. You know, what that means is that even if you had an abortionist who committed malpractice during the course of an abortion, and it resulted not only in the loss of the child's life, but also an injury or even death to the pregnant woman, the state would not be able to take adverse action against them. That means no criminal prosecution, likely no malpractice action for the mother or her family, because that would involve the state through its court system taking action against someone who performed the abortion. Even worse, that provision right there refers to someone who aids or assists a pregnant individual in exercising their right to reproductive freedom with their consent. So that means it doesn't even have to be a doctor. So the folks who support the proposal would never tell you this, but that subsection 3 opens up abortion practice for nurses and physician assistants, and even for the so-called back alley abortions that they say they're concerned about. This would authorize someone to perform a back alley abortion with no medical expertise whatsoever, and they would be entirely immunized by this statutory this constitutional language.
But aren't there other Michigan laws that say I could not practice as a physician or do physician work because I'm not a doctor?
They sure do. But what this says, this is the constitutional provision, so this overrides any statute, and it says the state cannot penalize, prosecute, or otherwise take adverse action against someone. So this overrides every existing law that we have on the books for protecting people from malpractice or just plain quacks who are trying to engage in the practice of medicine. It is a get out of jail free card for anyone who performs or assists in performing an abortion.
I do want to ask about the 1931 abortion ban. And, you know, there has been a lot of references to it as a zombie law, you know, because it was created in 1931, you know, from an older slate of lawmakers that unfortunately, you know, aren't alive anymore. Do you think the 1931 law would work appropriately in present day Michigan with everything that's changed?
Yeah, I think zombie is probably not a good word to use for an old law. I mean, we have a constitution which is 250 years old, and the free speech and religious liberty and other protections that it provides work pretty well today. So just because a law is old doesn't mean that it's a zombie. I have heard people use zombie with respect to the 1931 law because it hasn't been enforced for the 49 and a half years that Roe and Casey were on the books, but that's not even true because, as I mentioned, under the Michigan Supreme Court's ruling, it continued to be enforced, or could be enforced, post-viability, even during the Roe and Casey regimes. So what we're seeing is that there are other states that are adopting laws today that look very similar to Michigan's 1931 law. The Indiana legislature just passed a pro-life law that protects innocent unborn life beginning at conception just this last week. And so there's nothing improper about this. And if people want to have a debate about this, then let's do that. But let's not pretend that this constitutional amendment is simply about creating a so-called right to abortion. It goes much, much farther than that. And some of the details that we've been talking about are just the tip of the iceberg. So even those who might support a right to abortion generally that looks different than the 1931 law should be gravely concerned about a constitutional provision, one that will be in our Constitution forever until it gets reversed, that immunizes abortionists from malpractice actions, that allows non-doctors to perform abortions, that takes away parental consent rights, and that allows kids to have transgender sterilizations without their parents' knowledge.
Do you have an idea of where this language came from in that maybe there's other states that have had something like that, this, or this is kind of model legislation that a certain group has been pushing? Have you been able to kind of find the origins of this?
I have not. As far as I can understand it, that this is pretty much brand new and unique to Michigan. And it is the case that Michigan often adopts model laws. We have model tax laws,
sure.
We have model corporate laws, we have model trust laws, where a group of experts gets together and they say, okay, you know, this is a pretty, not extreme centralized proposal that many people could agree on. And now we're going to take this from state to state and try to get it enacted. I don't see any kind of a process that played out with respect to this. Someone in a dark room went, with pen and paper and really adopted the most extreme law that anybody has ever seen in the United States and said, let's put this in Michigan's Constitution. And, I'm sure when people were signing those petitions to put this on the ballot, they were being told, oh, well, this will just protect rights to abortion, and the state can still put reasonable restrictions on this. But that's really not true. I mean, going back, Kyle, to that opening language that you highlighted, even about the state's ability to put things on, if they have a compelling state interest that does not, or that only impacts protecting the mother's health and in the most narrow circumstances, in the law, lawyers understand that to be strict scrutiny. And those types of laws, when the government tries to pass them, are almost always struck down by courts because there are very few interests that are so compelling and so narrowly tailored that they can survive judicial scrutiny. Under the Roe and Casey regime, the standard for a state being able to pass pro-life protections for the mother's health had to do with the undue burden standard. That's a much lower standard in the law than the strict scrutiny that this proposal adopts. So even with respect to health and safety regulations, the state has been severely circumscribed. And then the language in here goes on to say that the state's interest is compelling only if consistent with accepted clinical standards of practice. Well, what are accepted clinical standards of practice for abortions? They're the standards that abortionists will agree to. So essentially, this is a get-out-of-regulation card for abortion clinics, unless it's something that they all agree is something that they're willing to accept. So when it comes to Michigan laws that require our abortion clinics to have certain standards of safety, like other surgical centers, if the abortion clinics don't want those are probably gone. Or other things that we have with respect to informed consent, those are probably gone too, because the constitutional provision imposes a voluntary consent standard, which is lower than the informed consent that we have for any other medical procedure in Michigan. I mean, it's really extraordinary. At every single point where they had an opportunity to pick an existing legal standard that protected women and that protected life, they went in the exact opposite direction.
I know that you've been following the legal steps that the governor is taking to try and keep the 1931 law from being in effect. Where do you see this playing out? How do you see this particular legal avenue ending?
Well, I represent Right to Life of Michigan and the Michigan Catholic Conference, seeking to intervene in that litigation that Governor Whitmer has instigated. And just a couple comments about the litigation at the outset. Highly unusual for a governor to sue to invalidate a law that she has sworn to uphold and protect as the governor of the state. You don't see this happening, well, at least in my lifetime. And in addition, a lot of what she's saying in support of the litigation is completely hypocritical. She says that one of the problems with the 1931 law is that it really puts women who are in economic hardship in a difficult position with respect to keeping their children. And yet in the last two budget cycles, she has line item vetoed $16 million and $21 million that was appropriated by the legislature specifically for helping those women. So she can't have it both ways. But on the legal side, that's a case that's likely to proceed through the trial court and up through the Court of Appeals, and it will end in the Michigan Supreme Court. and whether the Michigan Supreme Court actually addresses the arguments that she's making will come down to what happens with this proposal. If this proposal is adopted in November, there won't be any need for the Michigan Supreme Court to act. If people look at this proposal and see that even though they may support abortion, this is pretty extreme, then the Michigan Supreme Court will have to make that decision. Now, of course, the Michigan Supreme Court will have to ultimately do the same analysis that the U.S. Supreme Court did in deciding whether there's a right to abortion under Michigan's constitution. In other words, at the time that the Michigan Constitution was ratified in 1963, did people understand the language that they were ratifying to create a right to abortion? Now, keep in mind that the 1931 law had already been on the books for 30 years at that point, and I haven't seen a single instance of a person in 1963 suggesting that the Constitution's ratification would somehow invalidate that 1931 law. So the Michigan Supreme Court would have to find a right to abortion that no person ever recognized was there until today. Now, that's their prerogative if they want to do that, but that would really, really be stretching the limits of what we all consider reasonable judicial authority.
Now, I know that the pro-choice community has kind of raised alarm of, like, the 1931 law affect access to care in which abortion and miscarriage care kind of intersects. So, for example, like the abortion pills, there's been talks about how could this affect emergency contraception or the D&E procedure. You know, are those fair arguments? Because I also know the Right to Life community has kind of said that that's kind of a slippery slope misconception of sorts.
Yeah, I'll just be honest. It's an outright fabrication. When someone's had a miscarriage and you need to do a D&E in order to treat them medically, by law, that is not an abortion because you're not taking the life of the child. The child has already passed away through natural causes. You'll also hear them talk about ectopic pregnancies and that somehow the 1931 law would prevent a doctor from saving a mother's life in that situation. Well, Michigan defines abortion as the intentional taking of the baby's life. Well, a baby in an ectopic pregnancy can't survive, and that procedure is done for the protection of the mother's health. And so there's no reason that anyone would think that the 1931 law would apply to something like that. Now, when it comes to the abortion pills, that's a slightly more nuanced question because there are two kinds of those pills. There are pills that can prevent fertilization, true contraception, and those would not be covered by the 1931 law, which only applies to abortion, which involves a fertilized egg, when you've already got a baby that's growing, human and alive. But it would impact those pills that would prevent a fertilized egg from implanting in the uterus. That is the intentional taking of a human life. So there's a line that you need to draw there between contraception and abortive patients. But with respect to the ectopic pregnancies and the D&Es after miscarriages, those are all just misdirectional points that are being made by those who don't like and want to criticize the 1931 law unfairly.
So would it apply to the day after pill? Is that what you're saying?
It depends what you mean by day after pill. A day after pill that prevents fertilization, no. A day after pill that prevents implantation, yes.
In reference to the Supreme Court, do you think they'll weigh in before the election?
No, they would be crazy to do that.
That's what I thought.
Because, yeah, as I just said, for them to find a right to abortion in the Michigan Constitution would be a huge step given how you interpret constitutional documents, general understanding at the time that they were enacted. And why do that if the political process is going to take care of it for you? If I was their counsel, I would be saying, wait.
All right. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got as far as time today. We appreciate your time. John Birch, he is the Vice President of Appellate Advocacy for the Alliance Defending Freedom. Appreciate the time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Joining us now on the podcast is Justice Brian Zara of the Michigan Supreme Court. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
My pleasure to join you.
Well, the Supreme Court wrapped up its session just this last month on July 29. And it looks like you were the big dissenter in most of the cases, Justice, that you were on the minority more than anybody else on the court. What do you think is the reason for that? Why are people not agreeing with you anymore? What's going on there?
I
I'd like to think I've been pretty consistent. I've been a judge 27 and a half years now, and the entire time I've been one who professes a judicial philosophy of respecting the separation of powers, staying in my lane, understanding our job is to interpret the law. Certainly we have to check the legislature to make sure that they haven't exceeded their power. But by and large, the legislature can make the law and should make the law. We should stay out of that business. And I think I've been consistent with that philosophy. And over the course of time, the court has changed a little bit. And as a result, I'm dissenting more. I'm writing fewer majority opinions.
How do you think it's changed?
Well, there's been a change in the makeup of the court. And with new personnel comes varying judicial philosophies, and pretty much that, I think it's that has resulted in the change. So the judicial philosophy is a little bit more, the prevailing judicial philosophy of the court is a willingness to fill in gaps and to expound upon or even expand upon what the legislature has done. And that's not something that that is consistent with my judicial philosophy.
Well, that kind of brings me to my next question. How do you feel that Michigan's judicial system has weathered the present day state of political polarization?
How has Michigan's judicial system, in other words, everybody's fighting, and is our Supreme Court fighting? Is that the question?
I mean, just, you know, when you think about, you know, political polarization just like trickling in or trying to kind of seep its way through the cracks on either side of the ideological spectrum, you know, how do you think it's weathered what we've seen unfold as a country and as a state?
Well, I'm still proud of our Michigan court system. I'm dissenting more, but that doesn't mean I respect it any less. We are respectful of each other's views, and there's a difference of opinion, and we express them in, and I like to believe, respectful terms. Sometimes it gets a little sassy, but we aren't to the point where we aren't speaking to each other. We accept that some cases we're going to all agree, in many cases we're going to disagree, and you're not always going to agree or disagree with the same people. So it's case by case, and we're very professional about it. And I remain very proud of the court because it's not become a political body. It remains a legal body, albeit there are differences between us in that regard.
Do you feel like you're disagreeing, that you disagreed more this term than maybe the prior terms?
Well, I felt that way at the end.
Yeah. I mean, kind of the grand finale there, it seemed to be, things seem to be breaking down on a kind of a familiar 4-3 line there.
4-3 or 5-2.
Yeah.
So what's the question, Todd?
Oh, so did you kind of feel like things started breaking down along those kind of, I don't want to say the word partisan, but I mean, you guys are nominated by a political party and or appointed by a political person. Did they seem to break down along those lines, and why do you think that happened?
I'm not sure that it totally broke down along those lines, but to the extent it happens, I think it's in large part because governors who appoint try to find people who are consistent with their judicial philosophy, what they'd like to see come about. And when you get to the toughest of the toughest cases, people are going to divide along those political lines, or not political lines, those philosophical lines. So I think that's why.
You know, just to kind of give our listeners like an example, I mean, what was a case decision from this year that you felt most passionate about your dissent?
People versus Lucinski.
And tell our listeners what that was.
Well, I can't talk about it too much because there's still a period of rehearing. We're not, so opinions essentially speak for themselves. But it was a police stop in a rural county, I think it was Tuscola County. A deputy sheriff saw two cars in the roadway that were stopped and speaking to each other on a roadway that would have been a 55 mile an hour road. And as he approached, the cars separated. The deputy thought that this was impeding traffic and followed one car. One car pulled into a driveway and He followed into the driveway. By the time he got into the driveway, the driver had exited from the car and was walking towards the house. The deputy asked the driver if he could speak with him. The driver agreed to speak with him. The deputy observed, the odor of marijuana and alcohol, and the driver admitted that he did not have a driver's license. And charges arose from that, and the question was whether there was a seizure of the driver when the officer pulled into the driveway behind him, and even if there was a seizure, whether there was a mistake of law, because the majority of the court held that the impeding traffic statute does not require there to be, the majority found that the impeding traffic statute actually requires there to be impeding of the normal flow of traffic. In other words, if two cars are stopped and there's no traffic, that wouldn't be a violation of the impeding traffic statute. And so I disagreed. I didn't think it was a seizure. And if it was a seizure, I thought it was a reasonable mistake of law because there was a 20-year-old unpublished Court of Appeals opinion that was consistent with the deputy's position on the law.
In those decisions where there has been split decisions, what is kind of the most common theme that you're seeing as to where the split is coming from? A common philosophical split that you're seeing develop?
Yeah, you know, it's hard for me to identify a common split. Most of my dissents are because I believe the majority has exceeded their authority in the interpretation of law and actually crossed the line and filling gaps and putting things into the legislation that really weren't there. But for example, the Lucinski statute, the impeding the statute in Lucinski, the impeding traffic statute. I didn't think that they were expanding upon it. That was just a disagreement on whether in application it amounted to a stop that constituted a seizure of the driver, and then whether there was a reasonable mistake of law. So there's not any common theme other than to say when I'm dissenting, I often find that I just believe the majority has gone a little bit further in the role of judging. In other words, cross the line from pure interpretation and expounding upon what the law means into expanding and filling gaps and saying more than what the legislature provided.
All right, so you're going to be on the ballot. Not officially yet. You got to be officially nominated this coming August, August 27, I believe. The Republicans are going to be renominating, but you're an incumbent, so you can be on the ballot anyway, even if they decide not to, which I'm sure they will. What's kind of your approach here on the reelect? How are you approaching seeking another term on the Supreme Court?
Well, I've been around a while, Kyle, and this, I think, is my fifth contested election as an incumbent, and I've maintained a common theme, and that is to attend grassroots events and express my judicial philosophy and why I think my judicial philosophy is a better approach to the law, why my judicial philosophy results in equal justice under law. And then, money's the lifeblood of all elections. You got to go out and raise as much money as you can. So I'm doing a lot of fundraising, 1, 2, 3 nights a week. I'm out at various events raising funds. And then, raise what I can. And we're getting close to the time where it's time to spend. And then, hire professionals who do this for a living to advise on how best to reach your voters. And it's worked for me in the past, and I'm confident it's going to work for me this go around.
And what has been like, what is the response like when you go to those grassroots events and you engage with the voters? Especially because, this year in particular, we kind of saw a bit of mistrust between voter and incumbents. So is that something you confront at all?
I have not felt that or been confronted with that. And again, I come from a different perspective. People know I'm a judge, and so they've got a better understanding that we aren't
you know, we are a political branch of government. We're not out there making policy. So I haven't experienced any of that yet. As we get deeper in the election, I might, but we'll see.
How much do you hear from the folks at these events where they lament that we don't have Cliff Taylor, Bob Young, Maura Corrigan, you know, kind of that kind of majority on the court that kind of had the same judicial philosophy as you do?
So I don't hear those names, but I do occasionally, and I'll say even regularly when I go to these events, hear from people who thank me for being consistent in my philosophy. It's not lamenting that that's not there anymore, but it's gratitude that there is someone there who's willing to point out when the majority perhaps has gone further than I would, when I believe the separation of powers has been blurred. And so I get words of gratitude from people along those lines, and it's consistent with the, you know, the Taylor and Young and Mark McCorgan philosophy, but it's not. I haven't had anybody, you know, it's been a while, so you have to be pretty old, I guess, to remember those days and say, you know, bring me into that tent.
Do you think we should change how we seat our Supreme Court?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. I've been asked that question over the years. How we seat the Supreme Court. So is the question how you get on the court? Is it how you nominate? I think it's one of the most interesting and unique methods of putting people on the court, that political parties can just identify someone, nominate, and they end up on the court. No other judicial position in our state is like that. And there are partisan judicial elections in other states, but I don't think there's another state that nominates by partisan party and then runs on the nonpartisan portion of the ballot. And I understand. I've done a little bit of research, and at the convention for our last state constitution, the idea was we can ensure that we have quality candidates running for Supreme Court if we let the parties nominate. But if we're going to require candidates who want to run for Supreme Court to go out and get petitions, we might not have contested elections at the Supreme Court, or it'll be candidates that aren't the highest quality who go out and get petitions to end up on the ballot. So I understand why they did it, but at this point, I would say we should probably change. If we could change anything, I would change it. So it's just like every other judicial position in the state. The incumbents can file affidavits of incumbency and be on the ballot. People who want to run for that seat would have to go out and get petitions and then qualify in that way. Because the problem with the party nomination, as you pointed out, everybody's nominated by a party. I read reports at the end of this term, you know, when the cases came up, and the media always wants to report who is nominated by a Republican, who is nominated by a Democrat, or even worse, they'll just call us the Republican member of the court, the Democrat member of the court. I don't think that serves us well, because it creates the notion that the court is a political body. And even when I disagree and I call my colleagues out for what I think is policy making, I still don't think it's a political body. We are there interpreting law. We just come about it in different ways. So I would definitely want to change that aspect. Another aspect is elections in general. I kind of like a system where we have appointments rather than elections, but I wouldn't have lifetime appointments at the federal level. Perhaps a term of years at the Supreme Court, 14, 16 years, or maybe even a renewable term. Or you're appointed to a certain age, you know? And I always thought 70 was old enough, but the closer I get to it, maybe.
Right? Maybe not. Maybe not. Thank you, Justice. Justice Brian Zara, he is running for re-election for the Michigan Supreme Court. Thank you so much for your time on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thanks for your time. Thanks for inviting me to be a part of it.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. An apology to our listeners for the poor audio quality during the Justice Zara interview and the John Birch interview. Had a little technical issue over here that unfortunately could not be remedied. But we appreciate Mark Bayshore for helping us make it as sound as good as humanly possible, and appreciate our listeners, and hope you were still able to get some value out of the interview. We certainly did over here. Also, thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this on all our other podcasts. Appreciate our guests from earlier, Chris DeWitt, Josh Pugh, John Birch, and Justice Brian Zara. For Lisa Roos Church and Samantha Schreiber, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.